Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. We've got a great show for you today because Doug has brought on his brother to talk about patent law. But before we get there, are you looking for a better way to invest even during market turmoil? Consider Betterment. Betterment is a robo-advisor that uses modern portfolio theory to help manage your portfolio and reach your financial goals. With Betterment, you don't have to worry about what the market is doing on a day-to-day basis. Instead, use the stock market to help consistently build your wealth. For more information, visit moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment. I use Betterment to manage my own retirement fund and my travel fund, but that doesn't mean it's right for you. Head on over to moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment to learn more and to decide if Betterment is the right move for you. And now we'll turn it over to Doug.
Hey, everybody. This is Doug Goldstein from the Goldstein on Geld Show. Today, I'm in the driver's seat here at the Money Tree Investment Podcast. Today, we're going to be speaking to someone who is an international patent attorney. He teaches intellectual property law in law school. And in fact, you might kind of think his voice sounds a little bit like mine because he is my brother, Dr. Daniel Goldstein. I brought him on today because a lot of times I see that people don't really recognize the importance of intellectual property as it relates to investing. So, Daniel, let me just start by asking you, why is it that intellectual property is important for normal investors?
Normal investors are looking to invest in companies, I would think, that have something that's going to make them increase in value. It might be that you have particular technology that you own, and I guess that'll be the topic of our conversation today, but there might be other reasons why you'd invest in a company. You might say that they have a great name. For example, McDonald's has a great name. I love Big Macs, right? So I might think, I don't know about their technology. I really like their name. What's another reason I might invest in a company? Might be that they own oil fields, right? So they have something really cool. They have something exclusive that other people don't. And I guess the last reason you might invest in a company would be that this company works really hard and does something very well, even though they have no particular exclusivity, like a delicatessen, right? I like my local delicatessen. They don't have anything exclusive. There are other delis I could go to, but they're great. I really like going to them and they work hard. They have no exclusivity.
So how does that relate to someone who's actually just investing? I get the idea of exclusivity, but you know, some companies have it and some companies don't. How can you identify, or what's an investor going to be looking for in terms of that when we talk about intellectual property?
I actually think it's moderately difficult for a small investor to look at a big company, let's say Intel, and say, what is the value of their patent portfolio? I think that would be a fairly difficult question to answer. On the other end, if I look at a company like Intel and I see they're doing very good research and clearly they're doing good development and I watch their ability to increase sales, I might ask myself as an investor, why is it that they have such exclusivity? Why is it that so many computers have the sticker that says Intel inside? And that, I understand, is because they have patents. No one can copy their inventions, and they invent left and right in their various research centers around the world.
We all read in the news quite frequently that, especially some countries are known for using other people's intellectual property. So is there really a defense if the company has a patent when companies in other countries may not respect those patents?
I guess an example of what you're saying is many people feel that China uses intellectual property owned by others liberally. So it may be that they aren't really using something which you own. You may never have filed for a patent in China. If you don't file for patents in China for patent protection, and many people don't, it's expensive, you have to translate to Chinese, then you have no right to think that you have patent protection in China. They're allowed to copy. It's ethical for them to copy what you do in China. On the other hand, what happens if you actually file a patent application in China? You argue with the examiner in Chinese for a few years. Finally, you get your patent. At that point, if someone copies, in fact, in China, it's criminal. That person can and sometimes does go to jail. The problem is China's a big country. They don't exactly apply Western standards of law. Not that I'm saying that there are no standards of law. They do apply patent law and copyright law and trademark law. Nevertheless, Chinese attorneys have told me that one of the problems is that you may successfully close down that manufacturing plant, which sells competing goods, but then they just open it up in another district. And that's a challenge.
You were talking about Intel before, which is, you know, one of the larger companies, and certainly there are a lot of stories in the news about major firms that are getting into big fights about their patents. And for many of us, it actually might seem to have an effect on the day-to-day operation, for example, of our cell phone. But it feels very out of reach for the normal investor. And you said before, it's difficult for a normal investor to really understand what's going on inside the patent portfolio of a big company. So why should we really care about whether companies have patents, how they're protecting their patents, what the company's doing? I mean, at the end of the day, aren't they just going to ultimately manufacture some product?
Right. I think that gets back to what we were saying before, which is that you have to determine, I guess you often talk about diversifying your portfolio. So you have to determine what is the basis for your expectation of a profitable investment. So if you see a company that, again, that owns an oil field, you say that's the basis for my expectation of profit. Why, though, would I invest in someone who's developing technology if I don't even have a clue about intellectual property law? To some extent, I can rely on the CEO and the board of directors and just say, obviously, they're thinking that if they invest $100 million in R&D, research and development, they can probably expect they're going to get at least that back. And so now we understand that one of the bases for thinking you can get it back is, for example, patent law, right? Because they're able to patent their developments. Incidentally, there's another area of intellectual property law that Intel, as well as others, relies on, which is called trade secret law. Which is sometimes they might say, I don't want to file a patent application. All patents get published. So all your competitors are allowed to look at your patent a short time after you file it. You may say, that's awful for me. I don't want a 20-year monopoly if it means that someone gets to learn how to do my secret technologies. So in that case, you can rely on, for at least part of your research and development, you can rely on trade secret law, which says that it is forbidden. In fact, it's a crime in some cases. And it's also something you can be sued for. It's forbidden to take someone's trade secrets. What is a trade secret? It's a secret that is important for your commercial development and that gives you value because it's a secret, because none of your competitors know.
I don't quite understand the difference now between a trade secret and a patent. Could you just go back to the basics? When a company gets a patent, what are they actually getting? Who gives it to them and what is it?
A patent gives you a specific right in a given country. So for example, let's say you have a United States patent that protects your way of filtering data in a X-ray system. So now none of your competitors are allowed to sell an X-ray machine in the US that would use that particular filter. That might be very valuable because you're now able to filter data in such a way that you don't have to use so much X-ray radiation on your patients. So you're able to sell your device saying that you are able to get the same quality image with half the radiation. That would likely, if you're a good salesperson, that would likely improve your sales. So what does the patent do? The patent says no one else is allowed to sell such a device in the United States. No one else is allowed to build a device and then export it from the US. And no one's allowed to import it into the US. There are also other things that you get. So it gives you really a monopoly in the United States. If you also filed a patent in four other countries, then you get roughly the same rights in those other countries for that technology. That's patent rights. On the other hand, there are trade secret rights. In a sense, trade secret says, as long as you keep it a secret, then no one's allowed to use it, which sounds sort of circular, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, so how does that work?
The answer is the trade secret law provides strict punishments for people who violate your trade secrets. So someone takes your trade secret and profits based on it, you can sue them for your damages or for their profits. If someone takes your trade secrets, that may be a crime, and they, in principle, may go to jail.
Let's talk about the money side of this. How much is a patent actually worth? I get that you own it, so you're sort of describing it in the same way that an oil company might own real estate. You're saying that you own property also. It's just intellectual property. Can you put a dollar value to something like this, and how's that done?
I work in Israel. I work with Israeli medical device startup companies. It is common for Israeli startups to want to sell their company. In other words, they build technology, they show that they can generate sales, and then they have an exit, which is where a large, for example, medical device company based in America might buy the small Israeli company. Those companies may be bought for hundreds of millions or over $1 billion. We've seen deals that are of that scale. And a significant portion of that deal, not all of it, but a significant portion of the deal is due to the fact that there's market exclusivity for up to 20 years based on the patent portfolio. There are other values that the Israeli medical device startup company may provide also. But this is important. This shows that if you have a good product with good technology and you have a monopoly on it that could last for around 20 years, someone's going to want to pay for that because they might generate $1 billion a year in sales. That certainly gives value to the company.
It seems to me the way to make money on this for the small investor would be either to, let's say, find the small company in Israel that's developing the patent, developing the technology, and many of these, not all of them, but many of them may even trade on the U.S. exchanges and buy them, buy the shares then, and then wait until a big pharmaceutical company comes along and says, oh, listen, you've guys got a great cure for or a great treatment for Parkinson's, and we'll buy you for $1 billion. Does that sound to you kind of like a reasonable model for people to try and, you know, make not just a small return on their investment, but as you describe, you know, $1 billion buyout for a small company is huge.
Right. So as you know, as you have taught me over the years, there are some companies which are publicly traded and some companies which are not publicly traded, but which are privately held. So your proposal obviously would only work on a publicly traded company. And most small technology companies, in my experience, are not publicly traded yet. So there's no way you can reasonably go to a privately held company and say, I'd like to invest $100,000 in your company. The amount of time it would take you to do the research and to get all the contracts signed would erode most of the money that you were planning to invest. So your strategy is reasonable, but it would only apply in publicly traded companies, which are, I would say, a minority of startups.
Let's change tacks here for a minute, because one of the issues that you brought up, which is really kind of bugging me, and I bet is bugging a lot of other people, is you spoke about the possibility for a company to have a monopoly on a technology for 20 years. And in fact, one of the examples you gave was that maybe someone develops a technology that allows x-rays to happen with half the radiation. To me, this sounds like something that literally could save lives, who knows how many. It also seems a little bit unfair that the government is the one who's granting this monopoly, and it, you know, it's going to be between the person who's applying for the patent and the patent examiner, and they are literally able to keep a life-saving technology out of the hands of people who could use it. Why do we allow this kind of immorality?
Right, that's a good question. There was a famous case called Myriad, in which the large medical company, which was painted with a black hat by many people in the press, held patents that to some extent could be defined as covering the genes in your body. And so people found that offensive. I find that that's not offensive because Myriad developed a product for detecting breast cancer in someone who is still asymptomatic. And so if you have such a test, the patient is able to go get treatment or be tracked much earlier and have a much higher likelihood of living. You could say, so shouldn't that be not patented so that anyone can sell it at market value without the monopoly-induced increase in prices? The answer is, if you don't provide a company like Myriad with a high likelihood that they will be able to get 20 years or so of patent protection based on their many, many millions of dollars of investment, hundreds of millions of dollars of investment, then they're not likely to invest the next time. I have heard people say that they don't want to invest startup money in certain companies based on the patent environment around that particular technology. So it's important for the lawmaker and for the courts to consider whether they are actually hurting the patients when they say that they want to reduce patent protection, even though they think that they might be helping the patients in the short term.
Okay, we're just about out of time. This has really been very interesting because there are not only investment issues that arise when you're talking about patents, but there is actually the moral question too. And Daniel, I think you covered that very, very well. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks a lot, Doug.
Wow, thank you, Doug. That was so great. I learned so much about patents, about investing in yourself, and what you need to know to protect your own intellectual property. And speaking of protecting your property, have you ever wondered if there was a way to avoid the stress of a volatile market? One way is to let the robots handle it. Betterment offers a way to invest using the time-tested principles of modern portfolio theory, and an emotionless robot takes care of the rest. Answer a few questions about your financial goals and how much risk you can handle, and Betterment will construct a portfolio designed to help you build consistent wealth over time. I use Betterment to grow my own retirement portfolio and even meet my short-term travel needs. You can find out more at moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment. Find out if it's right for you, do the research, and decide if Betterment can work for your portfolio. Again, that's moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment. And now back to Doug to run the panel portion of our show.
Great. I am very happy to have three other robots with me here today. We've got Linda P. Jones. Linda, how you doing?
Hey, Doug. I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. It's funny that we actually aren't robots, and probably a show like the Money Tree Podcast wouldn't be so good with podcast, but it's excellent today because we actually have sitting in for Joe Saul Sehi, our good, good friend, Katie Brewer. Katie, how you doing?
Hi, I'm Katie Brewer, not Joe Saul Sehi.
And Miranda Marquardt, who you heard just before. Miranda, it sounds like you're nursing a cold, but thank you for trudging out through the snow just to be with us today.
Well, you know, us robots, I got to do what we
can. Yeah, we don't worry about that kind of weather stuff. Weather. So actually, I think it's very interesting to talk about this whole question of patents, because when anyone is investing in something, one of the biggest questions a lot of people ask is, well, what do I really own? I remember as a kid when I used to talk to my parents about stocks, you know, my mother actually was an investment advisor also. I would ask questions like, so you buy a company, what does that mean? What do you get? And she would say something like, well, you know, if the company does well, the price of the stock could go up. And she would say that you might get a dividend one day if it wasn't paying a dividend. But I got to tell you, it was always very confusing to really get what it is that you own. Like, you're an owner of a company. And now I want to add one more level of complication, which is, what does it mean when a company owns intellectual property? So, Katie, let me start with you. Do you think that investors should try to understand the intellectual property portfolios of companies if they want to invest in an individual stock?
Yeah, well, and I think you and your brother made some really good points that there are certain industries in which this is probably a lot more important. So, for example, in the technology industry, the company is really as good as its products. The products are really as good as their intellectual property protections. And so I think that's a really important industry to kind of understand both the products and the financials behind it, and also maybe how those are protected by intellectual property protections.
How about you, Linda? Do you think there's a way for people to really wrap their heads around this whole concept of intellectual property and what the real value is of it?
Well, I think it's definitely difficult to value, but I remember when Warren Buffett said he liked to invest in companies that create a moat around themselves. And this would be one example of having a moat, which would be something that's exclusive to just your company. We don't know the size of the market that that invention was created for, but if it's a very large market and it potentially could be the sole patent or intellectual property for that market, then it has great potential. And so that's something definitely to consider. It's hard in an early stage to know exactly how much market share they could get, what the growth rate could be, how important that particular patent could be, because there could be competitors that don't have that exact intellectual property, but have something else that might accomplish the same thing, might even do it better. So it does entail a lot of risk, but it is something that can be of enormous value if it's done correctly, and if they are first to market and it's a very large market, or if they are the best in the market and it's a very large market, I probably should say.
Miranda, what's your take on this? Because there's certainly a trend, which I think has only happened probably in the past 5 or 10 years, maybe a little bit longer, where there's this whole concept of freeware, and there's so much out there that someone will literally develop something publicly. And the idea is that it brings in a lot of programmers or a lot of thinkers to help develop it. Things like the operating system Linux to compete with Microsoft Windows. And, you know, look, you just go onto the iTunes store and you'll find a huge amount of free stuff. It seems on the one hand, we're talking today about protecting intellectual property and finding a value to it. And Linda's pointing out that it's difficult to know what the value is. But how does that jive with the fact that there's so much free stuff out there also? Is there a model for making money, you think, with giving it all away?
Well, I mean, we talk about giving things away all the time in the retail world. I mean, they have what are called loss leaders, right? That bring people in, they pay a very small amount of money. The company, the retailer, the store often loses money on those items, but people stick around and spend money in other ways. So you have that aspect of it as well. With companies are giving something away or giving something away for really cheap, chances are they have another product or some other way to make money off of you. In today's world, who knows, it could be selling your name to a list somewhere. I don't know. But anyway, but that's something to think about as well. And, you know, that brings us to user agreements in our world today, right? If you're using something that's freeware and you've agreed to the user agreement, have you agreed to allow them to sell your name to a different company? Because now they're making money off of a list. They're not necessarily making money directly from you using the product, but they are using it as a way to sell you to somebody else. And that's how a lot of these free companies kind of make their money. And then, of course, there is another model, which is the, you know, pay what you want model that relies on humans to see value in something and just pay it. I don't know how much I rely on that model myself to be profitable in the long term. But most companies have a plan if they're giving something away for free, whether it's a website that's giving away free information, maybe they want to make money off of affiliate sales. I mean, you know, make money off of sponsorships. We've done that here on our own podcast. There are ways to make money that go beyond just giving away a free product or a free license. And looking at how a company makes its money can be really telling, especially when you go back and say, well, I'm going to evaluate, where is their revenue stream going? Where's that money coming from? What are some of the factors that are going to affect that cash flow in the future? So really understanding where companies make money is important. And that's especially important today too, right? I mean, Uber is getting ready for an IPO next year. And we still don't know how they're going to make a profit. And then you also look at the example of MoviePass, and that has just gone down in flames. So it's really important to say, okay, what is the revenue model? And is it sustainable? And what's going to impact this revenue model in the future? And I don't know if I really answered your question, but I did go off on a long rant.
I'm so depressed that Miranda just told me there's no free stuff.
Right. Yeah. Basically, yeah, no. There's someone somewhere when they're offering this stuff expects to make money along the line somewhere. It may not be directly from what you're getting from them, but somewhere along the line, they expect somehow to make some money.
Well, I mean, if we look at old line media like TV and radio, wasn't that their business model was to offer it free and then sell advertising and have that support the radio station or the TV station? So that was their model, right? That's, you know.
Isn't that everything we see now with Google and Facebook? And oh, basically, yeah. That's their big model.
Oh, definitely. And that's the thing. I mean, heck, that's our model right here.
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. Listen, if you're providing a value to someone, and in return, you're going to, you know, advertise some product to him. So, all right, that's the deal. I think everyone knows about it. I think it's interesting from an investor standpoint to try to figure out how to actually make money. Katie, let me turn to you on this one. You are the president of Your Richest Life. And so tell us about getting rich with investing in possibly small or high-tech startups where the intellectual property might be the only thing that they really have. It literally could be a dozen people working in a garage somewhere, developing some program that they're not going to be able to do anything with it except hopefully sell it. Is this the type of investment that you think normal people should be looking for as part of a diversified portfolio?
I mean, well, honestly, if someone's trying to get into a tech startup that's at that point, they would probably have to be working there. It's really hard to invest in a company that's not public yet. And usually a company won't go public until they're actually making money. So, I mean, you might make more money on those tech startups that have done an IPO. But, you know, for example, Facebook and Google, you couldn't really invest in those companies before they actually went public. So, and to back it up, I always recommend that if people are doing kind of play money type stuff, which I put this into that category, if you're kind of putting this as like your big win, like your investment lottery ticket, look at your portfolio, shave off maybe 3-5% and just put that in whatever the heck you want, whatever your best friend told you to do, whatever high tech, you know, startup that you want to put it in, but make sure you protect the rest of your portfolio just so that you don't see the whole thing crash into the ground.
I do want to add kind of a fun story that I put in my Wealth Heiress book. And that was a masseuse that was working to massage the shoulders of weary tech employees. And instead of taking compensation, accepted options from this very large tech company. And we all know how that worked out. She made millions of dollars on that. So that was one way that an outsider actually got to invest without actually investing.
That is so
interesting. Do you think, Linda, people should take advantage of some of the crowdfunded venture capital or angel investment deals? Or literally, if if a friend of theirs says, "Hey, I'm going to get do a startup. Can you give me $20,000?" Do you think that's a smart thing? I'm obviously you're not giving specific investment advice, but type of thing that someone who's a long-term growth investor should try to make part of a portfolio?
I actually don't think it's a good idea for the average investor. I think it's way too high risk. I think the average investor would be much smarter hitting singles than trying to hit a grand slam. And so I think that the average investor should just get their money invested and, you know, have a good asset allocation model, be well diversified. And if they want to take 5 or 10% of their portfolio, maybe put a little in a technology sector or some other sector that might be up and coming, that's a different story. But putting in a startup is basically rolling the dice. And I have been involved with venture capitalists, not from an investment perspective, but from being involved in the management side with them. These people are of substantial net worth who are not even risking a lot of their own money, actually. They might be putting their time and expertise in, and they're bringing in outside money of people that literally, you know, have hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars and can invest $10 million and not worry about losing it all. And so that is a different story. And that, you know, is where it makes sense for someone to take risk when they have enormous amounts of money that they can just lose and it's not going to impact their net worth. But when someone's starting out, I really think it's a huge mistake to go too risky and try to make it big on something that probably is a real long shot.
I'll tell you a story also that happened that I was involved in. There was a startup that was looking to get some money from me, in fact, to invest. And they had some cool high-tech thing that had to do with lighting. You know, they just really wanted a few thousand dollars from me. But there was another guy who had put $1 million in and was getting a seat on the board as a result of being involved in the startup. And so I spoke to a friend of mine who was this big New York lawyer. And I said, "Listen, I'm thinking I'm putting some money into this deal. And it looks really good because it's true, my few thousand dollars, no big deal. But the guy putting in $1 million is going to get a seat on the board. And he's got a lot of skin in the game. So it seems like I'm kind of on his side and I'm just going to go along on his coattails." And my lawyer friend told me, he said, "Doug, you got to look at everyone's interest involved. Just because this guy is putting in $1 million into this business, how do you know that he doesn't have $50 million invested in the competitor's business? And not only is he going to put $1 million here, but he's going to get a seat on the board. And he has no interest in seeing your company do well because he's got something else up his sleeve that he's working on." So even though you might feel, for example, if you get in with a group of other investors and you think they really know what they're doing and you all have your interests aligned, he said, be very, very wary of these kind of deals. And I thought that was great advice to walk away from, is when you walk into a deal, you need to know what every single person's interest is before you say, "Oh, you know, we're all in it together."
Also, you need to make sure that you're not looking at what other people are doing when it may or may not actually meet your goals and your values and your portfolio.
Yeah. And I think one of the important things is understanding the burn rate, because the burn rate is the rate that companies can go through the capital. And it can be very quickly where they're burning through millions of dollars and then they need to go get more funding and may have difficulty getting more funding if they didn't get some profitability on the first round of funding that they got. So the amount of money that's wasted, lost, burned up, used up, however you want to say it, is enormous. And so therefore the risk is really great in these companies. And they often have to go through multiple rounds of funding in order to get to a point where they can be profitable and profitable enough to have an exit strategy where they can go public and get the shareholders paid back and make some money on the deal, because it can take a while and it can take, you know, a lot more money than people typically think in the beginning.
And not only that, where the money goes is so important, because I remember in the late 90s when everything went up in value and everyone was so excited. And Israel, in fact, where I'm based, had a huge number of high-tech exits and lots of people were making lots of money. And all of a sudden, we began to notice that as these companies would bring on new investor money, they would do renovations to their office and they had like the coolest office. And, you know, we'd go visit them and they'd give you the best coffee and, you know, from these really neat machines and great lighting and everything was fantastic in the office. But they had no business. And what was happening is investors were throwing money at ideas that would never do anything. It was all just literally a dog and pony show. just trying to get more investors to throw more and more money in. It's really very scary. Miranda, let me turn to you because one of the benefits of investing in a company that has a patent, and hopefully a really good patent, is that it gives them kind of a monopoly in their area. And yet there are many other companies. In fact, what Linda was saying before about the whole Warren Buffett idea of a moat, there are many other companies that do sort of have a monopoly in their area, or they are just such powerful forces in their area. Do you think this is a sure sign that company is going to do well in the future?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think it can help, and it definitely gives a company a leg up. But there is so much about running a business and growing a business and being a successful business that goes beyond just the product or just the patent. One of the things that has been very interesting to me as I've been able to interview venture capitalists in the past, right? I mean, I talked to them, and to a person, the idea and the product are less important to them than the team. Is the team able to pivot if something goes wrong? Does the team have grit? Are they going to stick with the business and make it succeed? Is the team competent? All of these things, they're more concerned about the team than the product or the idea, because you can have the greatest product in the world. You can have the greatest idea in the world, but if there's no execution, if there's no competent execution of that, the business is going to fail. And it doesn't matter what the product is, the business will fail. And so, well, it's great to have a monopoly in the area. It doesn't you no good to have a monopoly in the area if you're a terrible business person and just screw it all up. I like the idea of, you know, yes, definitely it gives them a leg up. It's something to consider and say, okay, they're going to have the corner on this market. They're going to have the corner on this product, but how are they going to manage their company? How are they, like you were talking about before, how are they going to burn through their cash? How are they going to make money off of this product? And then what happens later on down the road if somebody creates a competing product? Something that's a little bit different, but accomplishes the same purpose or does it better, is the company going to be in a place where it can adapt and move forward, right? I mean, for the longest time, Microsoft had a corner on the operating system market, and they still really kind of do. But, you know, more and more people are using Apple and OS. Being able to diversify or being able to confront challenges and be ready to adapt to the future is just as important as having the patent on a great product.
And I just want to agree with Miranda. I think the management team is so important. And, you know, oftentimes these management teams have proven themselves and they've done these kinds of enterprises before, shall we say. They've come in, they've taken new technology and they've built up the company and then brought it public. And they do that over and over and over again. Then the venture capitalists are more likely to reinvest in those people too. That's where you see a lot of success happening. I think we get caught up in this idea of the lucky lotto ticket, you know, like, oh, if we have this right idea, it's suddenly this multi-billion dollar idea and we're going to get rich from it. And yes, there's probably a very small percentage of people that happens to, but more likely it's the person that actually gets into an existing market, like the Dollar Shave Club, who started their business as a razor company, but it was delivered to people's homes. And then they built it up into such a big business that behemoth giant in the industry had to go buy them out. And you see that in the beverage market. You see that in the food market, the beauty industry. You see it in lots of industries. So if we have budding entrepreneurs out there in the audience who are listening, I would recommend that they go into an already established line of business, that they're not infringing on someone else's patent. They can improve on something in some way and let the bigger person in the industry buy out their company and have that be an exit strategy for them.
Katie, what's your take on it? What do you think an investor should look at in terms of if a company has a monopoly, either a government-granted monopoly like a patent, or they've just really become very powerful in a certain sector?
I mean, I think that's important to look at, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to improve the stock from there. So a lot of times, if you didn't get in on the ground level, or if you didn't get in before they had that patent or before they had that monopoly, you know, it might make it look good going forward, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be that big lotto ticket, like Linda said.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think another area that people have to be aware of is that companies use monopoly prosecution against their bigger competitors when they can't get a foothold in the market, oftentimes simply because their product isn't so good. And there's example after example of the government going in and trying to break up monopolies, claiming that it's causing some sort of price gouging. And really what you discover is that the competitors are either big donors to the party of whatever government is involved in that time, or they're simply making a big deal out of something that isn't a big deal. I was reading before an example that in the 1960s, the government forbade two shoe companies, Brown Shoe Company and Kinney Shoes, from doing a deal. Brown Shoe Company was going to acquire Kinney Shoes. And it turned out that the government said, because this would create a monopoly and would, you know, destroy the fair pricing of shoes. It turns out, but between the two of them, they had under a 2% market share. And this is not a monopoly. This is not where you control everything that goes on. And then Miranda was talking about Microsoft, which before Microsoft, it used to be that IBM was the big player. They had a huge market share. And then the government sued them for being a monopoly and kept them in court for well over a decade, during which time Microsoft was able to actually build up its position in the market. So even though we as investors might look for a company that has a very strong market share that some might consider a monopoly, I think monopolies tend to be a very political question in many ways. And if you're investing because you think you can make money because you've got the monopoly, watch out, because at any time the government could come along and just take it apart. All right, and that's the conversation for today about patents and about monopolies and about investing and really being very careful about investing. But one of the things that I think everyone should be careful about is finding where you get great information about investing. And not only by listening to the Money Tree podcast, but the panelists themselves each have their own things going on. Let's find out what's going on with the whole team. But let's start with our guest. Katie, tell us about the Your Richest Life Planning blog.
Yeah. Well, actually, I just did an article not too long ago where I talked about my favorite money podcasts. So when we're saying, hey, you should check out different, you know, resources that are available, I just actually wrote a blog post. So it's yourrichestlifeplanning.com/blog. And just a couple of different ones. I have a couple of doctor finance related ones, but also general finance related ones and investment ones on there. And also, I tend to just write about, you know, kind of how to stay motivated towards your goals and intermingle that with some more technical things like open enrollment, what you should review, IRAs, paying off student loans, and all of that fun stuff.
Okay, sounds terrific. Miranda, what's going on at Planting Money Seeds?
Check out Planting Money Seeds. We've got some stuff on there about what to do at the end of the year. What should you do with your money? Should you get ready? What are some last minute things you can do with tax deductions? So check out plantingmoneyseeds.com for information on how to organize your year-end finances.
And Linda, how's the book going and what's going on in your world?
The book is selling out on Amazon, so we had to reorder to have more in available for Christmas orders.
Wow.
And holiday orders. So that's exciting. If people want to get it for the holidays, please order quickly. On the podcast, Be Wealthy and Smart, we have a listener question who asked, should they remodel or start investing? And the answer might not be what you think I might say. So check that out at Be Wealthy and Smart or at lyndapjones.com/podcasts. How about you, Doug? What's going on with you?
Well, I have actually been talking a lot because more American brokerage firms have been telling Americans who live outside the United States that they need to close their brokerage account because these firms are telling these Americans that we will no longer work with you if you don't live in the United States. And this is especially problematic for people who have retirement accounts like IRA accounts in America, because the firms say that in 60 days, we're going to close your account and send you a check. And that could be a huge tax problem as well as just a hassle. So I've actually done a number of articles and webinars on the topic from my corporate website. And anyone who's in that situation should check out profile-financial.com. And if you've gotten such a letter from your brokerage firm, be sure to contact me at the contact button of profile-financial.com. Okay, that wraps it up for today. Thank you all. Thank you, Katie, for joining us. You were a fantastic guest panelist on the Money Tree Investment Podcast. Miranda, what can you tell us as we close up today?
Thank you so much for listening this week. Remember, you can always subscribe to us. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher, and everywhere other fine podcasts are sold. You can have a new episode delivered to you every Friday morning. Don't forget, too, that you can check us out at moneytreepodcast.com. You can see our latest episodes, take a look at past episodes, and you can find out more about the panelists and some of the resources available to you. Remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do, so invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.